Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The writer Susan Dominus told us this week she's been reporting her book, The Family Dynamic, since she was in fourth grade.
So when I was a kid, my parents used to go away on these long business trips. But often they also just went on vacation, just the two of them, so they could have some time together. And they would leave us with family friends.
The house was located just a few blocks from our own, but its rites and rhythms were distinct from ours. In our house, members of our family could reliably be found after dinner enjoying 80s-era sitcoms in a small den. I don't remember what our family friend's three sons did during those hours before bed, but I know the television, located in a room off the kitchen, went untouched.
They would sit around the dinner table, and at a certain point in the meal, the father would turn to one of his three sons and say, "So, Daniel, a plane is leaving New York, flying 8,000 miles an hour," and he would have one plane leaving another, that meeting another that was leaving at a different time. There were these very elaborate verbal math problems that the kids were expected to work out in their head over the dinner table.
A ritual of mathematical sport I enjoyed to no end until the evening when the father posed such a question to me. After an interminable silence, my mind entirely blank, I burst into tears.
It was, for me, an eye-opening experience because I realized that in some families, the parents were doing this very concerted thing of trying to enrich their kids kind of wherever they could, including at the dinner table. And I absolutely compared that to my own home where, you know, we mostly kind of squabbled around the dinner table. And, you know, the main thing we were expected to do at the dinner table was chew with our mouths closed.
At the same time, I did find myself reflecting on other possibilities of which I was now aware. I had been given a window into just how varied family culture could be regarding expectations and the cultivation of skills.
You know, how would I have been different had I grown up doing math problems in my head, or had I been expected to speak, you know, in an authoritative way about current affairs? I wondered if maybe I'd have more confidence, if maybe I'd have more skills. I definitely thought about what life would have been like in an alternative universe. My mother grew up quite poor, actually, and as a result, she was a very, very cautious person. And their hopes for us mainly were like financial stability, job security, play it safe. And I think I was always interested not just in people who were conventionally successful, but people who had grown up believing that they could write the great American novel, or were encouraged to think like, sure, I could become an Olympic athlete. I was very interested in families that cultivated the sense that it was not just okay to dream big, but it was exciting and encouraged and empowered. So when I set out to write the book, I wasn't necessarily interested in, you know, people who came from financial privilege, who went on to very secure jobs in banking or the law, you know, people who kind of were carried by a conveyor belt along the way. I was interested in people who had done things that were bold, I thought, or took bravery, or were trailblazing, or required real vision.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Susan Dominus's new book is about how some families manage to create a culture of reaching, of boldness, how they foster independence and openness. And while this kind of family environment can produce extraordinary kids, it can also be intense. There are costs. It's not always easy to grow up in a place like this. And Dominus says once you establish that kind of culture, you can't really predict what will happen. You can't ordain that your kids are going to become great doctors or scientists or artists. And by the way, maybe none of that has much to do with the parents at all. It could be the siblings who are shaping the conditions for success. Or maybe it's just luck. Susan Dominus is with us for the hour. Her book is called The Family Dynamic.
Because I've always had this question in my mind about people's upbringing and how it fostered their success, I often look at the Wikipedia pages of people whom I admire to see what their childhoods were like. It's just a funny little habit of mine. And I was reading one of Lauren Groff's many wonderful novels and got curious about her, went down a little rabbit hole, read a bunch of interviews, and then looked at her Wikipedia page and very quickly stumbled on the fact that her sister, Sarah True, was an Olympic triathlete. And it really blew me away because the idea that one sister could be at the top of her field in literature and the other one could be at the top of her field in sport was so intriguing to me. The book idea started coming together in my mind. And when I called Lauren, I said, yeah, I'm thinking about writing a book about high achieving families. You and your sister are so incredible. And she said, oh, yeah, but the really impressive one is my brother, Adam, who is the oldest in the family and is extremely impressive in his own right. He's an MD, PhD, who has started several very successful healthcare businesses. He's a serial entrepreneur who has done very well doing good. It was just funny to me that after, you know, all of her success, Lauren Groff was still under the impression that, you know, her brother was the impressive one. He is indeed impressive, but so is Lauren.
Yeah. Let's talk about the story you tell when Sarah was, I think this is so telling. Not that there's a one secret sauce, but I think this is such an interesting moment. The time Sarah True, then Sarah Groff, is 14 years old, and she wants to swim at Seagull Lake, which is right by the family home. It's this 9-mile lake. Would you tell us that story? We can sort of break down what it is, the moment when Lauren wants to swim the lake and she talks to her family about this, the reaction. Tell that story.
Sarah True, when she was 14 years old and still Sarah Groff, had decided that she probably was never going to be the student that her older sister and older brother were, and she was going to really throw herself into being a superb athlete. They were all very athletic kids, but it wasn't a passion of theirs the way that Sarah thought it could be for her. So she knew that she could really excel. And she was 14 years old and told her parents that she wanted to swim at Seagull Lake, which is 9 miles long. I mean, that's hours and hours of swimming. Many adults try and give up in the middle. You know, amateurs, it can take as long as 8 hours to swim the length of that lake. Her parents weren't that interested in having her do it because she was a little bit of a sensitive kid and they didn't want to see her be disappointed, you know, or crushed if she couldn't make it. But I will say, to their credit, they didn't let that fear of her failing to succeed stop them from letting her take the risk. And so she not only swam the lake, but it turned out that she broke the town record for men and for women and in all age categories. And that is a record that still stands. So it was a really formative moment for Sarah. It was the moment she left her mark on the family and on the town, which is why it is interesting that 4 years later, Lauren decided she was going to swim the lake. Yeah. I don't think she did it thinking about breaking or making a record. It was just something people did. They swam the lake and she was a good swimmer. So as was true for Sarah, her dad rode alongside her. And towards the end of the swim, he actually let her know, you know, if you picked it up a little bit, you could probably beat Sarah's record. I think it was information that was delivered very neutrally. Yeah. But Lauren thought about it a little bit, and she's a pretty competitive person. In the end, she just kept swimming at the same pace she was swimming at, and the record stood. But it's interesting, as a parent, I think a lot about that moment because you don't want to hold one kid back, you know, so that the other one's ego will remain intact. On the other hand, this was Sarah's thing, you know, and Lauren had her thing. So I think he was in a tough position. And this moment, I think it instigates a lot of strong feelings in people when they hear the story. You know, how could they even dare to possibly encroach on Sarah's record? But I have to say, as the mother of twin boys, I sort of understand where he was coming from.
Yeah. I mean, the thing he says, as you relay in the book, is just so you know, if you picked it up a little bit, you could beat Sarah. Which I find a lot of, there's something artful in that. As you said, it was kind of delivered neutrally. It's like, And you could tell Jerry, this was the father, felt conflicted about all of this. This was Sarah's thing. You know, Lauren might actually beat her. It was so great for Sarah. So he just says, just so you – what do you think that meant, just so you know? And let Lauren then make the call.
Yeah, I think he said, just so you know, which is different from saying – if he had just said, you know, if you pick it up a little bit, you could beat Sarah's record.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a clear incitement. Like, hey, let's have the Groffs set another record and it'll be even faster than the last one maybe, you know. But he didn't say that. It was, I'm just telling you this fact, do with it what you will. And then it was her decision to make, as opposed to her getting to the end of the lake, realizing her time was within spitting distance of breaking the record and looking at her father and saying, why didn't you tell me? You know, I think he felt like he had a due diligence to let her know because she was going to know how close she was at the end anyway. But I do think he said it in a way that was, I think, given the family dynamics, implied you could do this. Do you really want to? That's what I heard as the subtext in the way it was delivered.
Yeah, I did too.
I'm only telling this so you know. Yeah. You know, I'm not telling you this so you'll necessarily do something about it.
There's this question from their parents that all of the Groff kids say that still kind of works in their lives, even now. And that's, what's next? What do you find in that question?
You know, I think Lauren says that the question, what's next, is both the bomb and the whip, in the sense that no matter what they accomplish, there's the sense of, okay, now what? And on the one hand, it's the bomb because it's not making too much of whatever you have just accomplished. In other words, if you care too much about winning, then you also care a lot about losing, right? So what's next is a sense of, okay, you know, life is about the living and about the doing, and it's about growing. So keep moving, keep growing, keep changing. But there is in all of them a sense also that they can't quite rest. You know, for Lauren, it's all about her next book being the most groundbreaking, the most conversation starting, the most world changing. And for Adam, there's the sense that there's always some healthcare solution out there that could help more people, and that he needs to make it happen and make it happen at a bigger scale. And for Sarah, you know, it's what's the next race and what's the next record or what's the next career? You know, now she's getting a PhD in psychology, I think probably in part to answer a lot of the questions that came out of her childhood.
I mean, this is the cost part, right? Because it seems exhausting in some ways, like it's never going to be enough, that sense of being driven to the thing that, you know, what's next.
In the book, I write about this moment when Sarah True is competing in her second of two Olympic triathlons. And she has some kind of physical reaction after the swim. She's on her bike. She's in Rio. And she just can't get back on the bike. She's sick. She's ill. She's cramping up. It's caught on video. It's very painful to watch. The family was devastated. The family that was watching from home on TV. And then her mom and sister were watching from the sidelines. And Adam said, you know, he knew that Sarah would be devastated because even though she was still one of the best triathletes in the world, if she wasn't going to medal, it kind of was going to mean nothing to her. He said, that's the dark side of all of this. And by all of this, he meant the pursuit of glory, the pursuit of greatness. The dark side is that even if you achieve something pretty amazing, it's still never going to feel like it was enough. And it can be really devastating when you disappoint yourself.
I want to ask you about what you've described as this culture of boldness that you would find in families. Some the families that you profile, but also the Epstein family, Anya Epstein. Tell us a little bit about her and how your relationship with her, good friend of yours, influenced your interest in the family dynamic.
I'm really happy to talk about Anya because, and especially her father, Leslie Epstein, who was a great novelist himself, but he just died actually in the past week or so. So he's been very much on my mind and certainly on his family's mind. They're grieving right now because he was such an extraordinary person. So Leslie Epstein was the son of Philip Epstein, who was the brother of Julius Epstein, and they both wrote Casablanca along with another third author. And they were very irreverent. They were questioned during McCarthyism about whether they'd been involved in, you know, communism. And they were asked to name if they'd ever been involved with a communist organization, to which they replied, yes, Warner Brothers. This was, you know, in front of Congress. And they were very fearless and set their own rules. And, you know, they played tennis all morning and then wrote for a few hours a day and, you know, were always kind of putting their thumb in the eye of Jack Warner. And then Leslie came along there, you know, and became this tremendous novelist who got a PhD in theater at Yale Drama School. And he had very high expectations for Anya, some of which I witnessed myself as her friend. But she always tells this story about how they went to see a play in Boston, and Anya got very excited about the performance and jumped up to give a standing ovation, and her father yanked her back down to the seat and said, Boston audiences. He was not impressed by this production or the audience that was giving it a standing ovation. So Anya grew up to be a very successful showrunner and screenwriter, and her brother is Theo Epstein, who, for people who follow sports, was a general manager who saw the Red Sox to victory for the first time in decades.
And then the Cubs.
And then went on to do the same thing with the Chicago Cubs.
Incredible.
He's legendary.
Yeah.
I know, they're an incredible family. And then Anya married Dan Futterman, who wrote the movie Capote that either won an Oscar or was nominated. I mean, just very high achieving. Oh, and also Theo's twin brother, Paul, I think in some ways is the family member of whom the parents might have been most proud, just because he was this very beloved social worker in Brookline where he grew up, who, you know, created a teen center and also just helped so many kids, so many impoverished kids in the area, and is just really devoted to the community.
I think the thing that interested me about that part where you were writing about Anya and her family were, like, what you were seeing there. You talked about that boldness. But you also talked about a sense of irreverence that was there, that there was this wit that you noticed. There was this just joy and pleasure with language, but also a sense of justice, clearly, that was reflected in those stories about the McCarthy era and the blacklisting and all that stuff.
No, that's right. I'm so glad you're talking about this, because Leslie was very witty and he also was a prankster. I mean, someone was just telling me a story about how he used to hide the coat of the professor in the room next door just to listen to him say, you know, stomp around demanding to know where his coat was. I just silly, like a little prankster, and was very, I can't quote him right now, chapter and verse, but he was very wry and had this great giggle. But he also was a very moral person. And, you know, he's a writing professor at BU. And so many people have talked about the acts of generosity and the ways that he changed their lives. And, you know, when you're a professor, you know, you are to some degree devoting your life to helping other people get better at what they do. And I think in that regard, he was carrying on the tradition of his father and uncle, who were not going to be cowed by pressures to denounce other, you know, fellow writers as communists or that kind of thing. So it was this culture of boldness. It's irreverence in the face of cant or bias that they did not think was worthy.
Did you get a sense that Leslie or any of the other members of the family, even his grandparents, you know, Leslie's father, that they were passing on these lessons, or that was just the water they swam in? They were just absorbing through osmosis these lessons. Because I think that's a message for parents. Like, you don't need to point this stuff out. Kids are seeing and absorbing this stuff. Did you learn anything about that?
I think that there was a lot of explicit talk about how much they admired what Paul was doing, for example. They were very, very proud. And so that idea that serving others was a value in the family was very explicit. There's this idea, if you want your kids to be better, like, you have to be better, you know? And I don't mean in terms of, like, accomplishments, but just how you move in the world. Now, that's more easily said than done.
Yeah.
But I do think in these families in general, they were living their lives, and kids overhear at the dinner table what's being talked about. They see the choices the parents they're making. They hear what people say about their parents. what impresses other people about their parents. And that gets in you for sure. You know, the Murguias, as I said, you know, they went on to hold positions of national prominence. One runs the biggest civil rights organization for Latinos in the country. And Mary Murguia is the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit. And their brother, Ramon, is a very prominent Latino philanthropist. And their mother was somebody who had no fame. She had no education. She did not really speak English fluently, but she was so giving. And she, Ramon always told me that she was cooking for seven kids, so she was swamped all the time. But if a neighbor came by with a letter, and that neighbor couldn't read the letter because the neighbor was illiterate, and this letter was from a family member, the mom would put everything down, every dish, every, you know, turn off the flame, and sit down and help that neighbor so she could hear from her family member. So, you know, it was reinforcing the values of family, but also just giving and generosity and community and kindness. Those were themes that were very salient to the kids. They saw that in their mom. They saw she was admired for that.
I was curious about this thing that you wrote. You mentioned that for Anya's mother, narrative was at the heart of success. Narrative.
I think storytelling is at the heart of a lot of families who achieve, actually. And part of that is, what is the story that they tell themselves about the family that came before them? You know, were there stories of triumph that get into the hearts and minds of their children? I think for Eileen, who, had she chosen to, would have been a great psychologist, I think she spent time, you know, she ran this beautiful clothing store, and women would come and spend so much time trying on clothes, but also just sitting and talking. And the stories of their lives were something, I think, that got in her and that she also brought home and shared with her kids. It's a way of understanding the world through the drama of even the most humble lives.
That's Susan Dominus. She's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, also a lecturer in the English department at Yale University. Her new book is called The Family Dynamic, A Journey into the Mystery of Sibling Success. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the writer Susan Dominus about families that manage to produce a lot of high achievers. You know, the ones where all the kids end up as judges or novelists or world-class athletes. Her book is about how that happens, like what was going on around the dinner table in those homes. Were there family rituals or expectations or maybe even a motto that guided them? And what she found was there's no magic formula, and that kind of intense family culture also comes with a cost. Sometimes it's less about the parents and more about the siblings, and a lot of it, turns out, is just plain luck. Her book is called The Family Dynamic. Tell us about the Paulus family. And there's one line I want to ask you about: watching without desire.
Yeah, that is a line that sticks with me also as a mother. So the Paulus kids were raised by Lawrence Paulus, who was an arts producer at a TV show in New York City, and his wife, Taruko Paulus, who is an immigrant from Japan. And she really had quite an extraordinary story. She was, I think, orphaned by the time she was 18 because of World War II, and had carried her brother on her back to safety at some kind of a refugee settlement after he'd served in battle. She met her husband while he was, you know, a GI serving in Tokyo, and moved to the United States eventually, where they married. But she and her husband had in common this passion for the arts. And they really just wanted to expose their children to everything New York City had to offer. And they lived just blocks from Lincoln Center, which is some of the greatest arts programming, theater, dance in the country. And they were lucky enough that their daughter, Diane, was actually able to dance with the American Ballet Theater when she was just a girl. She was on stage with Baryshnikov and being directed, choreographed by the greats. And Diane says that her mother came to every single show, every performance, even though she herself, her mother was quite exhausted from the seamstress work that she did every day. But she had a way of watching without desire that Diane believed was very zen at its core. And that meant to her that her mom was there to support her and be a mother to her, but she was never there to be a stage mother to her. She was not one to encourage Diane to go for bigger parts. She didn't critique her footwork. She was just there for her in a very quiet way that made it clear that whatever dancing Diane did was for Diane's gratification. Not her mother enjoyed it, but she wasn't doing it to please her mother or to get her mother's approval.
This seems to be like a really important theme in the book. I mean, one of the things you get at is that these parents don't explicitly go around talking about ambition or accomplishing things necessarily, but they, and this is how you put it in the book, they create a culture of reaching just by setting the bar high in their own path. It's not ambition for ambition's sake. For many parents, the goal is just to make these kids feel like they're equipped to reach for something important, like this larger purpose, a larger sense of meaning. Say more about that culture of reaching.
I was very struck that two different families had a very similar way of seeing the world. So the Holifield family in Tallahassee, Marilyn Holifield, who desegregated a high school, told me that the unspoken motto in that household was all things possible, because her own parents had overcome so much themselves and had gone on to basically build, as a Black couple in Tallahassee, managed to build a real estate fortune, having come from pretty much nothing themselves. The Murguia family, those kids were raised by a mom who used to say, with God's help, all things are possible. Although she, you know, didn't necessarily see her kids ending up in the positions they ended up in, she obviously did create a sense in them of sky's the limit, you know, and with God's help, all things possible. I think religion played a role in some of the families too. You know, Mary Murguia told me that her mother used to say the benediction prayer over their heads every single time they left the house. And so they used to go out into the world thinking they had this coat of armor that they could get hit by a bus and they would be okay. Their mom's connection to God was so strong that they felt very protected by that.
I want to ask you a little bit about the work of Julia Leonard. She has this learning lab at Yale, and you write about that she's, this is how you put it, taken up the question of what motivates kids to decide, you know, whether it's worth it to keep trying. And then you also write about her own relationship with her sibling. Tell us about Julia Leonard and the work and what she helped you understand about all this dynamic in the families.
Well, Julia Leonard was, you know, ended up having her own learning lab at Yale. So she's obviously done very well. And she was always a very energetic kid who, you know, wanted to ski fast and who wanted to build things and who wanted to learn magic and was just very energized all the time. She was an ice skater. And her sister, Sarah Rose, was a little bit of a dreamer and was not particularly interested in, you know, building 10 snowmen or, you know, whatever it was. And it used to frustrate Julia, who wanted her sister to try harder, even though I think Julia's ambition came with some amount of anxiety for her as well, whereas Sarah Rose, her sister, was a little bit more laid back and I think took things a little bit easier as well. So eventually, Julia ended up studying what is it that makes, you know, even babies like 13-month-olds, 15-month-olds try harder? Was it having a parent encourage them to try harder? Was it watching a parent try harder with like a toy that they were trying to get to do something? And it turned out that babies who watched their parents, or rather I should say a researcher, try really hard to get this toy to like make a noise, let's say, that those babies tried harder themselves when they were trying a similar kind of task. So she was interested in that. Eventually her sister kind of called her out and said, did you study this because of me? And Julia said, no, don't be ridiculous. I'm trying to help disadvantaged youth, you know. But over the years, Sarah Rose herself became quite successful. She was, you know, she loved theater from the time she was young, and she became a dramaturg at Berkeley Rep, which is, you know, one of the more respected regional theaters in the country. Finally, Julia did admit that maybe there was something about her childhood that had motivated her. But she went on to study what makes kids unmotivated. Right. And what she found was that when researchers would intervene while a young child was doing some kind of a puzzle, it was extremely demotivating for the child. You know, when they presented a different puzzle in front of that child later on, they tried much less hard. And she also did research that found that parents tend to jump in to help their kids a little bit too quickly. Mm. And that if you can get them to understand that even things like putting on your shoes and zipping up your coat and, you know, clipping your own backpack, that those are learning opportunities, then parents would maybe intervene a little bit less and hopefully would avoid inadvertently demotivating their kids by intervening. So her work is really encouraging parents to let kids be more independent, to let them struggle, you know, with finding whatever it is that they've misplaced, not just because they need to learn, but because it's actually demotivating if you do jump in and try to do it for them.
Did you see that in most of these families, that they had, if not explicit techniques, but they were thinking about how you, you know, how you inspire independence in the kids?
I think they inspired independence by letting them make difficult choices, yeah. You know, whether that's swimming the lake or in the case of Marilyn Hoffield, you know, she came to her parents when she was 16, maybe she was even 15, and said, you know, I hear the best high school in town is now they're finally ready to admit Black students and I want to be one of them. Her parents must have known that was going to be a really, really awful experience, yeah. Which it was.
It was, yeah.
She has horrific stories about that time in her life. I mean, she got off the bus once and a bunch of kids just nailed her with eggs, you know, and the one Black employee at the school drove her home, the janitor. That's just one story. You know, sometimes Marilyn would say things like, well, that was just a Tuesday, you know.
Right.
But her parents let her do it. Yeah. She wanted it. She wanted the superb education. She did get a superb education. She graduated seventh in a class of something like, I want to say, is it possible? It was 2000. It was a huge school, but she did extremely well. And they let her do it, even yeah. though I'm sure for them it was really hard. She said to me, fear was not their thing. I love that.
Yeah. So you're the mother of twins, fraternal twins, which you say has given you a kind of a particular interest in, you know, consistency and maybe patterns. And did that also give you, because there's a part in, of course, we need to talk about that argument about the nature part versus the nurture part. Having fraternal twins, did that make your interest in all of that even more acute, I suppose?
I think parents of fraternal twins are really desperate for things to turn out just the same way for their kids. They yeah. want everything to be as easy for one as it is for the other. And I think parents want that for all their kids. But there's something about the concurrence of having kids, you know, go through everything at the same time. They're really, it's like mano a mano, you know, they're racing against each other in track meets potentially, or they are, you know, both gunning for a certain leadership position. And you just want, you don't want to see either one of them succeed at the cost of the other one. You know, it's that kind of feeling. So I do
you want to mention
that,
the Bryan twins? That's an extreme example that's that you write about in the book.
Yeah. So my kids are fraternal twins, but identical twins are fascinating in their own right because they're kind of as much like one person as two people ever can possibly be.
Yeah.
And the Bryan twins' parents really didn't want to see one of they really wanted their kids to be champions. And they didn't want one of them to be better than the other at anything because they thought, my God, if I can't even win at home, you know, in a pool of two, how am I ever going to win on the tennis court? And so there's this kind of incredible story about how one of the kids managed to hit a ball like over a fence or over a tree. And the father worked with the identical twin until he too could hit that ball over the tree. Like he just needed them to each feel as powerful as the other. If they were playing in tennis tournaments together, not as a doubles team, but as singles, if it came down to the two of them being in the last round, he would have one of them forfeit rather than see them actually compete against each other because he just wanted them to feel equal to each other so that they could go out and conquer the world, which as a doubles team, they really did.
Yeah.
They're the most winning doubles team in history.
But what did you learn about that nature versus nurture as you explored? We can talk a little bit about Augustine Kong, if you like. There's this professor at Oxford wrote this paper that really challenged thinking about nature versus nurture. Do you mind talking about that?
Yeah, I love talking about nature versus nurture because I feel like I kind of almost have a handle on it at this point, even though we're only starting to really understand it.
Yeah.
I think the best way to explain it is that so kids come into the world with, you know, a certain number of genetic variations, a certain pattern of genetic variations, let's say. They are a little bit who they're going to be from the moment they're born. Mm. And that's like a big chunk of what makes up the difference among people in a population. And then there's also, you know, their environment. And that is not just parenting. It's everything. It's the town you live in. It's the weather outside. It's how big your room was. It's what teacher you had. It's what nature show did you happen to watch on a Tuesday. You know, your environment is made up of a million billion idiosyncratic moments that only happen to you or in that particular pattern. So who we are is really a mixture of nature, you know, your genes and nurture. But nurture is not just parenting. Parenting is a small part of the whole environment that's influencing who you are. But what Augustine Kong found by analyzing, you know, large genetic databases, basically, was that even when kids don't inherit, let's say, so there are genetic variants that are associated now with high educational attainment, let's say. Mm-hmm. And what he found was that even when kids don't inherit those particular genetic variations, they're still more inclined to, let's say, go to college. They reflect. So it's like the parents' genetic profile is acting on the kids even when it's not inside the skin, is how geneticists put it. So it's a little bit complicating this. It's actually an argument in suggesting that maybe the effects of nurture are a little bit more than we even think, because what people were attributing to the environment all along may have actually, it's a little bit complicated. Maybe I'm bungling this, but it's just a way of saying that even when parents don't pass their genes on, the genes that the parents have are predictably affecting the kids in a certain way. Not invariably, but the likeliness is increased.
The part about Augustine Kong's story, though, that's really interesting was another one of those, seems to me anyway, one of those lessons that you learned, and that is the importance of, I don't know how to put it, delaying gratification. The idea, as Augustine talked about, people who can endure present pain for future gains. Is that one of the characteristics that was present in some of these families that succeeded?
Well, I think he was suggesting that could be one of the parental effects that could have some genetic basis that gets passed on through modeling and culture. You know, based on his own family's experience, I think it was his uncle had put many, many family members through college at, you know, great personal effort and struggle. I do think that gratification delaying was a big part of many of these family stories. Like, for example,
the Chens.
Yeah. So that one of the family's stories I find most moving is the Chens.
Yeah.
They had left China to flee the one child policy there because they had three children and the children's prospects were not particularly good, given that the government found ways to penalize families who flouted the one child policy. There were high taxes and other social costs. So the father first came to America and left the kids at home with the mom while he learned the restaurant business and saved some money and started to understand how a Chinese restaurant would work in America by working in other people's kitchens. And then the mom came over and left the kids back with family members or family friends in order for her to get set up in America and to help him set up a restaurant. So they really did sacrifice quite a bit and suffered quite a bit, the separation, so that the kids could eventually come over and have a chance at the American dream, which the mother always said was theirs for the taking. They just, all they had to do was work hard and they could have it. Whereas in China, they could work all they wanted, but because of the one child policy, those chances just weren't going to exist for them. So by the way, it's a good example of how the environment affects people, right? Like, no matter how much talent you have, if the environment is conspiring to keep you down you're not going to be able to express all of your potential. So the environment plays a huge role in people's outcomes. And they went in search of a better environment for their kids, which they found.
Yeah, this is a really complicated story, though, that, you know, Ying Chen, the mother, was driven, like intensely driven to have her children succeed in music in particular. And to talk a little bit about that, because this is, I don't know, what do you make of this, you know, being driven so intensely, the costs, I guess, of that?
So, yeah, Ying Chen, she herself had been deprived of musical education. Her kids think that her dad probably hit her quite a bit. And she herself, because she'd been deprived of a musical education, really wanted her own kids to take advantage of the instruction and the opportunities that they were given. And, you know, she was a traumatized person who was living in this country far from family and didn't speak the language. And when her kids disappointed her, or she was that she would go into a rage, and she did hit them. And I think they were physically scared of her. The kids did grow up to be very, very talented and accomplished musicians, but all of them would say that the cost of that was tremendous. I mean, she may have made musicians out of them, but the relationship itself suffered, you know, from that violence. And Devin, the youngest, would say that he thinks he became a musician only when he got to college. It was always just rote for him because of his mother's intensity and the fact that it was driven by fear and control. He would say he became a musician in a way in spite of his mother rather than because of her. It was only when he got to college that he really discovered his love of music and his ability to really enjoy it.
Susan Dominus, her book is The Family Dynamic, A Journey into the Mystery of Sibling Success. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Susan Dominus. We're talking about her book, The Family Dynamic. One of the things that we haven't said, and it's a really important part of the book, is that, like with the Brontes, you write about, you realized through that story that it's often the siblings who really guide this process of success. I mean, we've been talking about what parents do, but the idea of how do you understand now through these particular families, you know, what part is sibling versus even the influence of, you know, forget nature, nurture, just and parents? Like, how much of this is the dynamic, the good and the bad of just between the siblings?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I think that we overestimate parental effects on kids' outcomes and underestimate the emotional and other kinds of effects of siblings on each other. And I think that often when you see kids who are from a disadvantaged family who do manage to succeed at some high level, it's very likely that they couldn't have done it without the network effect of their fellow siblings because it's very hard, you know, to break out of poverty, let's say. It's very hard for anybody to reach a very high level of success. But if you have somebody in your corner who knows you, who gets you, who is rooting for you, who is loyal to you, who would put you above other people in their, you know, in their network, let's say, you have something there that people without siblings, frankly, do not have. And if you have four siblings, let's say, as is true of the Murguias, all of whom went to law school, then, you know, they're so much greater than the sum of their parts because each of them knows so many people and they're coming to the table with just enough overlap that they can be helpful. But then their careers developed in such different directions that they widened each other's horizons.
How much of it is luck?
How much of success in general is luck?
Yeah. I mean, because luck is a theme that you get at in the book. How much of this is just, you can't plan for any of this stuff, just sometimes happens.
Well, it's funny. Bob Waldinger, who's this wonderful psychiatrist, says He says that happiness is a matter of luck to some degree, but you can make yourself, let's say happiness is an accident, then you can make yourself accident prone, right? So I wouldn't say it's entire. You have to line yourself up for the luck to happen and have done the work. So if it does happen, you can make use of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's just this incredible story about the Murguia twins. The two youngest members of the Murguia family were identical twins, and they both wanted to go to girls' state, which was this wonderful leadership conference, and they had equivalent records. But somehow the adult who was choosing thought it would be weird if they both went because they were identical twins. And she wanted to pick one twin and then some other kid. And so she actually tossed a coin to decide which of these identical twins would go to girls' state. Janet Murguia won the coin toss. She goes to girls' state. She does so well. She goes to Girls Nation, which takes you to D.C., where you meet, you know, the staff of the White House. She ends up, you know, leaving the home right out of law school and moving to D.C., where she has sort of seen with her own eyes what life could look like. You know, by the time she's 30, she's like touring around as, you know, a liaison for one of the Congress people, flying all over South America, meeting heads of state and playing a crucial role. And her own sister, who had not gone to girls' state, was doing very well for herself, working as a prosecutor, but was still living at home, you know, because the family culture was like, if you're living in Kansas City, then of course you're going to live at home. That's where they grew up. And so their lives until they were 30 were incredibly different based on that coin toss, really based on that coin toss.
Yeah. Let me ask you finally, how all of this has affected your own perception and, you know, I guess your behavior, I suppose, as a parent. Like, you mentioned that when you started the book, your kids, which we mentioned already, twin boys, were young. Now they're in college, and you and your husband are empty nesters now. So as you reflect back, what did all of that mean for how you raised those boys, or how you think about how you raised those boys?
I think for me, the biggest takeaway of all of it was less about how to make them succeed and more about emotional resilience. That idea of you're tougher than you think was really important, I think, in our family. While I was raising them, I think at a certain point I did realize that I was probably intervening too much or not fostering enough independence. In that I, you know, because I had boys and I, at a certain point, like I couldn't keep up with them on the soccer field. I really didn't want to play video games. You know, there's so many things I couldn't do or didn't want to do. But what I could do was cook for them. So I made breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know, for basically 18 years. And I, you know, I think it would have been better if they'd been a little bit more on their own in that regard. At the end of the day, you can't help but glean from all of this that even though I was writing a book about achievement, what's most important are the relationships. When you look at the arc of someone's life, you see how short the period of time is that they live at home, you know? And so I think for me, even though I was writing a book about achievement, I think what I took away was that I really just wanted the relationships to be strong. And that at the end of the day, that of course, which we all know, those relationships are more important than getting your kids to perform, you know, that even if you could, quote unquote, make your kid practice for an hour a day, or whatever it is you felt they should be achieving at, is it worth it to the relationship? I'm not sure.
Well, it makes me think that parents reading the book are not going to be intimidated by these stories. Yes, the outcomes for a lot of these, like, it was extraordinary, you know, the success of some of these family dynamics. But I think if they get the big picture here, they won't feel like, oh, there's another thing that's just going to make me feel guilty about not having, you know, produced a Supreme Court justice or whatever. I think that, do you know what I mean?
I absolutely think that this book gives parents reason to take the foot off the gas.
Yeah.
Because luck is such a big part of it, because sibling effects that parents really can't control are such a big part of it. Because intrinsic motivation is such a big part of it, either your kid has it or doesn't. And also because there are real costs associated with success. And Mary Murguia talks about it. She said, no one who succeeds at a high level does not give up something else. You know, it could be relationships, it could be peace of mind, it could be leisure time. Everything is a cost-benefit trade-off. And I don't think anybody who is very successful would say it was easy. And it was always fun to have those high expectations of oneself.
Susan Dominus, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me and for your really thoughtful questions. I felt like you really got the book, and that was so meaningful for me. So thank you.
Susan Dominus, she's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a lecturer at Yale University. Her new book is called The Family Dynamic, A Journey into the Mystery of Sibling Success. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.